It's the art and science of making reliable inferences about people, behaviors, and systems so that you can understand the increasing understanding of the underlying structure and as it vibrates throughout the company, because something that happens in one department, you might not think it affects you, but it does affect people and their behaviors and other things.
Hey, it's David, and you're listening to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, your source for practical leadership inspiration, tools and strategies you can use to achieve transformational results without sacrificing your humanity or your mind in the process. Welcome, Season 10, Episode 5. So glad you're here. I've got some questions for you before I introduce our guest. I almost hate to ask these questions in today's day, but we have to. It'll help you know exactly where we're going. Have you ever felt faced with a puzzling pattern of events, been stuck in a confusing situation, or even felt trapped by your own routine thinking patterns? Or maybe you've wondered about how you think and how you make decisions during messy and unexpected situations. And if you're scratching your head as you answer those questions, do you have to deal with any ambiguity? And the answer is yes, you do. You absolutely do. In this day and age, I can't think of a more relevant topic for every leader listening right now. Our guest today is Dr. Debbie Sutherland, and she's going to give you tools, resources, and insights to help you increase your comfort with all those unknowns. So if you're a business leader, you're wanting to expand your thinking, your leadership capacity, maybe you're recognizing you have a knowing gap in business or life, or maybe you feel that it's time to understand your own biases and assumptions at a deeper level. This episode and Debbie's new book, The Business of Ambiguity, are for you. You're in the right place today. So Debbie is an expert in organizational behavior, system thinking, the hidden power of adult learning. She's worked in a variety of global roles in organizations, including international startups, and she's currently working as an executive in the United Arab Emirates, from where she's joining us for the show on a Friday evening, her time. Debbie, we so appreciate you being here. Dr. Sutherland, welcome to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul.
Wow, David, thank you. It's thrilling to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. And like I said, this The Business of Ambiguity, the full title is The Business of Ambiguity, Demystify the Unknown with 5 Key Thinking and Behavior Strategies. And I got to tell you, listeners, this book has so much. I was telling Debbie before we started recording that I don't know that I have seen a resource with this depth and level of understanding, analysis, research, and yet such practicality. It's just filled with things that you can take and think about and start using immediately while you're building your overall approach. We're going to get into all that. But Debbie, I got to start by asking you a personal question. That question is, can you take us back to your earliest memory of yourself as a leader?
Yeah, you know, I really would love to say that the earliest memory is a childhood memory where I learned those lessons really early in school or with groups or clubs. But I think I was a late bloomer. I was a young professional before I actually got probably those practical understanding of what leadership was. I think I've always wondered how people think. And I think that's probably why I'm in the position I am now, is I just kind of was on the fringe of the drama, just watching people and learning and what are they thinking. And so back in the day, I saw leaders or what I thought were leaders at that time were people who had firm opinions and maybe even strong or loud opinions, and they commanded respect in a meeting. So I thought that's what a leader was. And so I was like, oh, I'll have to learn a lot of details about something to have that strong of a conviction to be a leader. But that's what I thought leadership was. So I probably was a really good manager up to that point because I was organized. I was practical. I was getting things done and I had a big team and I was running it. I thought we were successful, but I did land in a big company and I did come into a big team, and I was there to help do a little bit of change management. And I thought that I knew that this team was very well versed in their roles. They knew their roles better than I did. And so I probably spent the first 3 months just asking questions. And I was in a very vulnerable state. I knew that they could probably be thinking that maybe I didn't know my own stuff. Why am I asking so many questions? How am I getting to know everyone? But what I now know what happened thereafter. It's obviously the little bit of hindsight that is helpful. Is they felt like they were in a well-held environment, that this change person coming in wasn't changing them. We were just growing the company and moving along the way. So I found out later that they became a better team because my other line manager had told me that. So I think that's the light bulb switch for me, is when I, oh, that's the difference between a manager and a leader.
And what I'm seeing in that example is so many of the seeds of this work that we're talking about, the business of ambiguity, and you showed up with some natural inclination or somewhere that you had learned to do some of the things that, that we'll get into in how you went about engaging with people, and so much to draw on there. So I want to get into that, but before we do, and maybe it directly, there's a direct through line from that experience to this question, but I am curious what led you to write this book, because, you know, I know it takes a while to write a book, written several, like it takes, there's a lead time to this. And when we look at the world right now, you know, I remember when I was young, change, when I was a young business person, change was, you know, local. There was a business leader or a new entity came in, or somebody was leaving, or, you know, things felt, they had a regional feel to them. Now, it's like whatever the global headline is seems to have a direct impact on everybody. And whether it's, you know, pandemic, whether it's the Russian invasion of Ukraine, whether it's, you know, environment change, you know, yeah, or climate change, whatever it might be, there are so many different of these aspects that I don't know that the world's more ambiguous than it's ever been, but I certainly think that it feels that way to many people. And so I'm curious, what's led you to this book? Why this book? Why now?
It's a little bit of a journey. It's born from my research, as you said, and then turned into a book. But it probably came from a sense of frustration when you want to make change or feel like you think there's a way to make change. You obviously want to solve all world's problems when you start your doctorate, but you realize very very soon thereafter that that's not the point. You just kind of give a sliver of insight. But to give you a little bit of insight into that journey, I had been working for a large scale startup here in the Middle East. And I had the privilege of working in some very centralized positions, probably with the HR team and the strategy team. And I think you can appreciate that most large scale startups are messy. For the first 18 months, maybe even 2 years, there's a lot of things going on and there's a lot of frustrations, fast directions, that sort of thing. And what you can see or you could feel is that some people don't on a spectrum of ambiguity deal with that very well. Either they're on one side and they're always making fast decisions and just moving forward because that's what you're propelled to do in a business. Or they stall the business because they just don't have enough information because you're in this ambiguous state and you just might never get the information that you feel helps you with a decision path. So that sense of frustration came from two areas. I was working with dignitaries, foreign diplomats, scientists in the renewable energy space, and CEOs, and not that directly, but I was in their sphere of influence. And there was just not enough leadership training. I just didn't understand how some people were gravitating towards it and were successful in this space. Was it their nationality? Was it the training they had? Did they come from Wharton, INSEAD, Harvard, any of these amazing schools that taught them this? And so I wanted to know the theory behind it a little bit. Training courses are fantastic, but I just felt there was something about the organization that could do as well. I did go to Columbia University. There's a program there. It's the XMA, which is, you know, Organizational Design and Behaviors Master's Program. But when I got there, I learned this concept called system thinking. And that's when the light switch went on. And I was like, that's what's happening. So systems thinking is, for anyone who hasn't heard this term before, it's the art and science of making reliable inferences about people, behaviors, and systems so that you can understand the increasing understanding of the underlying structure and as it vibrates throughout the company, because something that happens in one department you might not think it affects you, but it does affect people and their behaviors and other things. So that led me to research it a bit more. And then I went into adult learning concepts in my doctorate program. And for people who have done a dissertation, there's only four people. You spend years doing it. There's only four people who ever read it. It's pretty dense in its very academic prose. It's not nice to read, but I thought there were some really good messages there because I'm an academic practitioner at heart. Yes. So I wanted it to be practical. And so the book came from the research.
And it's such a good good model that to have that depth of research. And we've had a guest recently who, same thing, dissertation on the remote work environment, and said, okay, wait a minute, this is pertinent. This is now, people need this. So put the practical book together to help people with that. So I appreciate you taking the time and having the generosity of spirit to say, hey, this is helpful for people. Let's get this out here. So I'm going to come back to systems thinking in just a minute, because I do think that that's important for every leader listening to understand what we're talking about there and how they can use that and how it can help. But before we do that, you've hinted at it, nibbled around the edges, but I want to just, let's put it out there. When we say ambiguity, what exactly do you mean by that? When we're talking about leading in, working through, dealing with ambiguity, how would you define ambiguity?
Ambiguity can be defined as paradoxes that happen in the business or in your life in general. Imperfect information, conflicting information. And then in the business sense, I know it's really on your nose to say the pandemic was ambiguous for everyone, but even in the business sense, in your personal sense, when you're working through decisions and there's too many variables and they're changing variables, they're always dynamic and changing, that's an ambiguous situation. And it's stressful.
It is stressful. I'm thinking of so many of our clients that a couple of years ago, I don't know, about 5-6 years ago, I was working with a client, and they in the engineering space, and they had some public utilities that were major clients of theirs, and just a huge amount of ambiguity. Contracts would go and change from day to day, and it was maddening for them. And I remember sitting with the senior executive, and we were talking through it, and he said, I just don't know what I'm going to show up to tomorrow. I never know.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had that conversation and said, yeah, it's become one of the things that a core part of some of our teaching is that you can't always choose what you're going to show up to, but you can always choose how you'll show up. And that seems to be at the core of some of your, what you call the ambiguity mindset, is how you're going to approach ambiguity, how you're going to show up for those unknowns or those conflicting priorities or the paradoxes, how you're going to show up for that as a leader.
Right. Your show, Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, Ambiguity, Leadership Without Losing Your Cool. It's this, it happens. You don't necessarily, there's a lot of leaders that don't necessarily know how they show up during that really messy space. And that's where I was finding the gap, is leadership programs are fantastic. But do they give you enough tools for when you're in this very stressful state? Because it's just not, it's your business, of course, but static processes change when you're not even under paying attention. People's behaviors change, ebb and flow, and people move in and out of the organization. So it's hard to even keep track of what's happening in the invisible spaces of your business.
You know, and I think that's the number one element. I don't know any way to have this conversation without getting metaphysical, but but you know, there is that saying that nothing is certain in life but death or taxes, or you know, that if you want to go Buddhist, like impermanence is the fact of life, that is life, that the constant state of change and so on. And I know, and I'm speaking personally here as someone, and I can do the psychology, and I went, you know, go back to my youth and the impermanence and instabilities that I faced, and my desire as a leader to create structure and knowability and be able to forecast what tomorrow is going to look like and make that happen. That's something that drives a lot of leaders. And yet, it's kind of a fool's errand, isn't it?
So it's almost the paradox. The way you're talking is, it's deeply reflective. Like, you're taking your deliberate pause and you're thinking about the next step that you want to do. And when you're in that ambiguity, it feels like you need to get out of there fast. But based on my research, I obviously there's good theory that can support this, but I really wanted to interview a lot of executives who have been very successful in their careers in complex adaptive systems that they work in. And the research was showing that they have a deeply reflective mindset, that they are continually learning from their experiences and honing how to make action a better action in the future. So that's the paradox, because businesses are fast paced. We bulldoze through barriers and keep moving forward. It's hard to look back even quickly.
Yeah. And you have, and you get into the book and you get this in a number of different directions. And so I want to, we'll take some time to unpack this a little bit, I think. But as you're talking about that deeply reflective executive and leaders who succeed in the middle of ambiguity, they have this way of thinking and thinking about things. And it's not just what I would say kind of our normal fast-paced, get it done, and effective up to a point leader does, which is, all right, I've got today's problem, I got to solve today's problem, and then we'll move on to tomorrow's problem. That these leaders do something where they take a step back and they think more broadly. And I think that's what you're getting at earlier when you're talking about systems thinking versus, you contrast that with analytic thinking in the book, but systems thinking, where we're seeing the whole of the department, the whole of the organization, the whole of the ecosystem that our business sits in, where we're seeing all of the inputs and outputs and kind of looking at it from a much higher view in order to figure out what are the best or better solutions rather than just fixing today's problem. How can we actually fix the system? Right. If I'm understanding it correctly.
Yeah, it's absolutely correct. And when you were talking about systems, your arms are out and you're kind of like the big picture and the holes, not the parts of the business. And that's exactly what happens when you start systems thinking. You feel like you've just expanded your thinking patterns. You can't blame a marketing department for a product selling stall. You know, it's not selling well because it was probably not just the marketing department. It was the communication process. It could have been an employee turnover. It could have been the brief that wasn't done properly by another department. So it is the systems thinking aspect that I'll give you a theory, another one that most organizational developers have tattooed on their arm someplace. It's the Kurt Lewin theory of behavior is a function of the person in the environment. So if you have
I'm laughing because I had so many of these conversations over the course of my career as I'd have a CEO or somebody frustrated with an individual. I'm like, they're acting rationally given the system they're in.
Exactly. And so that's where the OD portion of the book comes into play in terms of ambiguity. You have to be looking at your environment.
All right, well, let's take this to the level of a leader. Let's say you're a senior vice president in an organization. You've got a department or a responsibility, like, you know, you used marketing earlier or what have you. And so you're looking at, all right, I've got objectives I need to meet. I'm not satisfied with where we are in this regard. And okay, yeah, I'm a part of a system, but how do I take responsibility? How do I actually lead in situations like that? Because I know you're not talking about just, I'm going to blame shift off to, well, it's not our fault, it's the system that we're a part of, right? So how, as a leader, how do I take responsibility and help us collectively create a better future?
So I think, and jump in here, but leaders know a lot about their own business. That by proxy, that they have more information than the rest of the business because they are the leader. But I think when you're in this, when something's not going well, they need to come from that position of curiosity rather than an expert's mindset, because they don't necessarily know everything that's going on in the other layers of the organization, not layers down, but, you know, laterally as well through the different silos of what's going on. So having an adaptable mindset. So yes, you probably have a really great strong thought of where the business should go. But it really is building that connectivity throughout the business and querying a lot of people. And that's just, and even people that you don't necessarily like their opinions of, and that's where harness the power of diverse networks comes from in terms of your outer sphere, is because you really need to find out everybody's assumptions of what's going on to be able to find the next best decision path.
And listeners, if you're paying attention here, you're hearing Debbie use phrases like adaptable mental models, harnessing strategic power of diverse networks. And if you recall, the subtitle of the book was, so we're talking about the business of ambiguity, demystify the unknown with 5 key thinking and behavior strategies. And so these are some of those thinking and behavior strategies, the adaptable mental models, the harnessing the strategic power of diverse networks. I want to take a little bit deeper dive there, because there's something that you said about adaptable mental models that I think is so important. And it helps set the stage for curiosity, because I think a trap, well, I know a trap that I have fallen into, and you call it out in the book, that the competency trap.
Yeah.
Falling into this thinking rut based on what we've done in the past that's worked. You know, so I know Marshall Goldsmith is famous for, you know, what got you here won't get you there. But there's this tendency that we become victims of our own success. So how do, from your research or your interviews, you interviewed so many executives, how do leaders overcome that competency trap and tap into a place of curiosity in order to not get stuck there?
So I'm going to go a little bit research based on this answer, because what came out of it was they had thinking behaviors of, yeah, okay, I can change my mind. That's great. That's a thinking strategy. Reading, that sort of thing, researching on your own of what the next best step would be. But they also had behaviors behind it. And they were seeking meaning from their own experiences. They were querying, like I said, and they were fostering connectivities across the organization. So they built those links so that they could gain information. I'll give you an example. How many times has somebody in a big business come to a meeting and everyone's shaking hands across the table when we did that sort of thing, and said, oh, I'm so-and-so, and they've worked 50 steps away from each other and they didn't know each other's names. It's so prevalent. It's because they weren't fostering those connectivities within the business. So as an example of organizational design, you really need to create those soft, informal meeting spaces, connectivity, engagement, like you were talking about that person's book. It's remote working. It's really important. You have to build those connectivities, but now we're missing out on that tacit knowledge sharing.
And intentionally creating that space and those connections. And yeah, there's a definite theme in so many of the experts and thought leaders that we've been hearing from around this. And, you know, and I'm thinking of some of the, again, of some of our clients who have built practices like this, where they're taking 30 minutes a week and intentionally just setting meetings, setting a not even a meeting is calling, is making it too formal, but just a time to get to know somebody they don't know. And so Perfect. Rather than allow chance, they're creating the chance, and who knows what will come of it, but at least now I know you and you know me.
Yes, absolutely.
So in order to have those deep networks, we're going to have to create them. That's part of what I'm hearing, is that your leaders who have succeeded in ambiguity, that's some of what they do. So we want to have an adaptable mental model, one that can stay curious and flex and so forth. I'm speaking for myself here. So I know that, and I can very much do the, all right, I know with, when there's this massive amount and overwhelm and conflict and I know what I have done in the past to succeed. And it's so easy. Those mental pathways are ingrained, that they they've worked, they have served me in the past. I get my dopamine when it works. And so it reinforces. Yeah. And that can limit me from being effective, as we've talked about. So how do I go about shaking that up? How do I, do you have any strategies to help me develop an adaptable mental model if I am feeling stuck there, if I'm feeling rigid, if I'm feeling like I, there's a way I want things to be and I need them to be this way, and I'm recognizing what you're saying, that I need to get more curious, but do you have any tips to help me get over that bridge?
So I guess what I think I hear you saying is, how do I bust my own assumptions and biases, and how do I even know I have them?
Right? Absolutely.
Yeah. So, coming from there was one exercise that we did, and journaling is not something that happens in the corporate world. But if you were to go to a leadership course, that might be the first thing that they do, is get you to self a 360 review, maybe journaling throughout the program. And that's, you know, academics use it, therapists use it, schools use it, but it's not very prevalent in the corporate world. And so, you know, even just keeping a journal for a few weeks and understanding what your triggers are when there's emotional attachment to it. Why did that meeting not go well? What were you frustrated about that person about? And then getting that self-awareness of, yeah, it was probably more me than them. This person was just bringing me information that I didn't like because it wasn't meeting my expectation of the project, but it's your passion project. So you had emotion attached to it that maybe you didn't know you had. And so that's why you blasted the whole team, and they came out of there feeling like they haven't performed well for you.
Oh, such a valuable practice. I know I have benefited from that so many different times in my own life. So the practice, so journaling is a way to create space to just examine ourselves, our own behavior. And then what did happen there? Let me actually reflect on that. Take a moment to reflect on that. And that's work that you can do for yourself through a journaling process. It's work you can do with a coach if you have access to a coach. And if you don't, you do. There were coaching available all over. But such a valuable practice to get reflective about what's actually happening. And then that's the first starting curiosity is, let me forget the system, forget the business, forget everybody else. Let me just get curious about myself. And if I can start there, that starts creating some space to do all the other kinds of adaptive thinking that you're talking about.
Yeah. You know, there's one more really easy one that businesses can implement that it's sometimes painful, and they may think it's a waste of their time. And that's doing lessons learned. You know, postmortems, as you call it, whatever. But it really is powerful for when you get to all sit in a room and without laying blame, because you're just talking about the project that didn't go well, but what didn't work in the technology side of things, the behavior side of things, the process side of things, the project scope, all of those things can be, you know, detached from an emotion now. It's done. But those lessons learned will carry you. And that's the learning from experience piece that obviously I was researching as well in adult learning. And then it resonates with the team.
And, you know, while we're talking about that, you there's another element, and you do address, I don't remember which section of the book it was in, but you do address this because it stood out to me. We like to call them post-project celebrations, even if the project didn't.
Nicer. That's even nicer.
I would much rather attend that than the post-mortem, right? And one of the elements of that we often, I think it's easy to overlook, is as we were talking through about the, okay, that didn't work out the way we had hoped. Let's figure out what do we learn from that. One of the other learnings that's available for us is in what did work. And let's examine that to make sure we're not unintentionally reinforcing an accident and saying, oh, this was a fantastic strategy, when maybe it was just dumb luck. Or maybe we just uncovered a new skill that we really do need to cultivate. Let's also pay attention to what worked and what can we learn from that.
Yeah, so that's the overconfidence bias. And then, you know, the Kurt Dunning, the effect is when you're in ambiguity, is sometimes you don't know, you're overconfident in the areas of of areas that you don't know much about. And I'm going to say that when we're immersed in ambiguity and uncertain situations, we're probably not experts in that space.
So true. So true. So cultivating that mindset is going to help us. Throughout the book, and I just want to call attention to this for listeners, throughout the book, as you know, Debbie will start with some theory and give you the research theory behind something, the different models that you've been hearing referred to, then get into some executive examples to make it very real. Here's how this executive in this situation deals with things. And as you go through the learning, each section concludes with a learning insight. And these, and I just call your attention to them, look for them, because there are so many very valuable questions in these learning insights where she makes it very practical, gives you the opportunity to reflect for yourself on what's happening there. And one of the other starting points I'd call attention to is there are some fantastic assessments. So if journaling sounds like too much work today, you're like, yeah, I need to get there, but what am I journaling about? I would direct you to some of the assessments that are in the book as well, because they will very immediately draw you to, oh yeah, this is where I'm comfortable, this is where I'm not, and help to start create some of that self-awareness. So while we're talking about that, Debbie, where can we find the book, the assessments, connect with you, all those good things?
The book is available at all global digital bookstores. It's where you can get a hard copy and the digital copy. They're not in physical bookstores, just the book was coming out during the pandemic. And I knew that, you know, people probably wouldn't be going to bookstores. You can reach out to me at my website, which is behaviorsinbusiness.com. And of course, Twitter handle and Instagram handles are behaviorsinbusiness.
All right. And we'll make sure and put all of those in the show notes too. But I would definitely encourage you, as you're thinking about how you're showing up and how you're leading through ambiguity, these assessments that Debbie has in the book are so valuable for that and will help guide you through where you're going to get the most value. I know that as I was reading that of all of the five behaviors that you talk about, the one, and I'm telling you, when I read through the table of contents, I was like, okay, I got to read that chapter. And so I'm just going to be selfish and take the listeners on this journey. We're going to talk about developing comfort in the unknown. Because I think of all of them, that is, to me, all I've got so many other skill-based things, but boy, it comes down to this. If I can get comfortable here, all right, I got a chance. I've got a chance to lead. I got a chance to, how did you say it? You don't know what you're going to show up to, but you can keep your cool. You know, and part of that comes from comfort. I'm not scared. I'm not threatened. I'm not at risk. So developing comfort in the unknown. Some people that seems to come fairly naturally. They like that kind of a space. But for those that it's more challenging, how can we go about developing comfort in the unknown?
Yeah, that was an interesting chapter. And that came purely out of the research from these executives, is being immersed in those uncomfortable situations as a leader, of course, that happens all the time, and jumping into it, leaning into it. And I think in a business sense is we probably don't do enough stretch projects for people who've been in their role for a long period of time. We're not cross-pollinating departments enough so that you're getting everybody who's in this state of, oh yeah, I've experienced that. This is what I did here. And then you can start to have that really cool dialogue to help you with the next step. So it really is about leaning into going into new clubs, pushing yourself into new situations, asking to be moved into a different department if you can. It's very hard. But again, that's the paradox of businesses. They want you to be flexible and adaptable, but they keep you in this role for a very long time and you're doing routine stuff. And I think that's what came out of the research. If you're doing routine stuff enough times, you're going to feel comfortable in that linear thinking of how you've always done it. So really it is demystifying the unknown, maybe not the fear of the unknown, but just at least demystify it. So it's not a fear state.
Demystifying, creating familiarity. So that's what comfort is on some level. It's I am familiar with this unknowing, with this ambiguity. And so some of the ways that you were just talking about, you know, we can do that for our people. As a leader, we can help create some of those opportunities for stretch, for different, where we're not going to be able to rely on our routine knowledge. As a leader myself, if I'm sitting here going, yeah, but I don't have a stretch thing like that, that's not happening right now. There are a number of things. I remember reading, and you talk about this, where find ambiguous situations for yourself, and they don't have to be work related. You know, you can, pick up and maybe there is, you can take an assignment that's different than what you would have normally gone through. But in life, there are so many different places we can put ourselves that are new. You know, take an improv class. If I've never done that before. I remember Peter Drucker talking about, or somebody who had interviewed him, they were talking about how he would, every year or two pick up and try a new thing he'd never done before. Like, I'm going to learn how to play the cello, because it's incredibly humbling. You don't know so much. And as long as you're continuing to make your brain do that, you're cultivating that ability to be okay with not knowing.
Yeah. You know what's really prevalent now that I think maybe people might resonate with is the side hustle. Everybody's gravitating to a side hustle now, whatever that may be, doing blogs, doing a website, learning a new craft. I got to tell you, you're so messed with so many indecisions if you want to build a website. There's so many beautiful ones out there. You don't know which direction to take. It can be as simple as that, but come on, let's dig in. Let's see. You'll learn new things. You'll meet new people, and then you'll understand a little bit more. And that's okay. That's a wonderful experience to take away from. You've tried it, and now you've got something to show for it. And then you can tackle the next one.
And it doesn't need, and I think it's important to also reference the, as a side hustle, it doesn't have to be for money. Like, it can be a hobby. It can be an experience. It can be, hey, I'm going to try to do this. And who knows what will come of it? It may become a passion project. It may become volunteering. It may just be something learning and interesting. And then we go on to the next thing. And it's okay for us to have those things. In fact, it's more than okay. It's actually very healthy and helpful.
Yeah. You know what? There's this one piece of research I saw years ago that line managers tend to promote people who've got outside interests.
Oh, I haven't seen
that. And now I was kind of thinking about that. Is it because it makes you more interesting? Or, but I'm assuming now that, based on my own research, it's because you're probably well-versed and you've got a different mental model that's just not on the deliverables of this business, and your line manager found value in your diverse interests.
Can imagine. That's interesting. I hadn't seen that particular piece of research. So as we're talking about developing comfort or familiarity with the unknown, so we've talked about like putting ourselves in ambiguous situations, whether that's at work or if nothing is readily available there, or there's so many other opportunities. Some other things that we can do to get familiar and get comfortable with ambiguity and the unknown. You talk about challenging assumptions. And at first I read this, I was starting to scratch my head going, okay, now, in every organization, you got that person that just challenges everything. That's not what we're talking about here as I unpacked it and explored it. What do you mean by challenging assumptions? How do we develop our comfort with ambiguity by challenging assumptions?
So on the practical sense of what you can do in your own organization, whether you're the senior leader who has impact into creating that change within the organization, or you're a talent expert and you're building your leaders within the organization, is one of the things that's worked really well is just having that coaching culture and building that within the organization so that there's this one exercise in the book. It's quite old, actually. It's the ladder of inference. If you feel somebody is running up that ladder of inference where they're making assumption after assumption after assumption, you can quickly cool that down going, well, where are you getting that information? Can you tell me more? So you just slow it down and you help people understand their own thinking. So they're saying, oh, well, I was thinking this. And I said, oh, that's interesting because I completely saw it this way. So it comes down to that critical dialogue, which we've implemented at a coaching culture before, or trying to get to those ethos where it's okay to ask people to explain their thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and as a leader, you can do that. And as a leader, you can also do that for yourself. I used to have this bumper sticker. It wasn't on a car. It was like on a notebook I had. And I'm sure it was, you know, back from the 60s, like, don't believe everything you think. And I just love that. Don't believe everything you think. Like, I got to question my own assumptions. And back in my early days, both in education and then in business leadership, you know, I'd have conversations and somebody would say, oh, well, I can't do that. And whatever the topic was, well, I can't do that. Like, who told you that?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I don't know. Okay, well, why do you believe that? You know, and that whole questioning of our assumptions and challenging one another's assumptions and building a community like you were talking about earlier, where like maybe I can start small. Maybe I can just get two other managers who maybe want to go on this journey to maybe there's two other vice presidents in the organization. And let's do that for one another. And maybe we're trying to break down silos in our complex adaptive organization and build bridges with one another. Well, why does that exist? Does it have to? How can we and start getting curious about those things and create that space to question with one another? Who knows what can happen?
Yeah. And normally those types of things happen in leadership and events, and it gives you the tools and the vocabulary so that you can test it out in the business. One of the things I was helping the leaders, the senior leaders, is if somebody is going to give you a project, a finished document, the deliverable, is just push back lightly and say, did you talk to three different departments about this? Because three different departments are going to have different insights into that product or whatever it is you're delivering, and not necessarily that you have to implement what the different departments say, but it does kind of put it in the back of your mind that people will think about this differently if it's delivered and has you addressed everybody's ideas. So it's just a light pushback. Again, it's another organizational mechanism to make sure that you're using systems thinking in your business.
And as you're doing that, and even if they haven't, you can build it into your project plan of, okay, listen, I am going to expose myself, yes, to some alternate ways of thinking here, because I want to make sure we're delivering the best possible thing. And so some basics, I mean, our project manager's going, yes, stakeholder, get them in there, right? The more of those perspectives you're able to get, like you said, it's not about satisfying every single one, but if you understand the bigger picture and the whys behind what you're doing, you're going to be able to do a better, more effective job, whether that job is a product, a service, a process, whatever it is that you're working on.
Yeah, and stakeholders, and even that takes on a different twist if you're talking about your external stakeholders, because they're also maybe going through an ambiguous situation. So whatever you thought their partnership values were with you, they may have shifted as well during this uncertainty. So really kind of understanding that power dynamic, interest dynamic. We've done mind maps for certain teams when they're embarking on a project, so that they can really start to think on the invisible, I keep calling it the hidden, or the invisible links. Have you thought about them? Who has obviously overt power, but who has the reverent power? Who's really going to make the decisions? Have you really thought about that?
We're talking with Dr. Debbie Sutherland here. She is obviously, if you've been listening, an expert on the business of ambiguity, helping you to lead through ambiguity, demystifying, and I love that term, demystify the unknown with five key thinking and behavior strategies. So it just, as we're running out of time here today, we're talking about different ways of thinking, different ways of approaching the mindset we can develop, the ways that we're reflecting, the ways that we're interacting with other people, exposing ourselves, the point of which all of it, if we want to succeed at leading in ambiguity, we got to get comfortable with it by getting accustomed to it and getting our brains used to, hey, this is a thing. I got to stay humble. I got to stay learning. I got to stay curious. by building networks of a diverse range of people so that we're getting exposed to different ways of thinking. So we have that resiliency of a lot of different ways of processing and dealing with whatever it is that we're showing up to. And all of this helps us, as you said, to stay cool, to stay grounded and centered, and be able to lead from a place of influence through ambiguity. So I would like to give you the final word here, Debbie, as we land the plane, bring it to a close, pull into shore, whatever metaphor we're going to use. As you have worked with leaders who have really done an excellent job of leading through ambiguity, is there anything we haven't talked about that, you know, here's practically something else, just one more thing that I would leave, that you'd want to leave our listeners with to help them thrive in their leading through ambiguity?
I think you did an amazing summary. I don't know how I could add to it. I guess it's the power of behavioral science in what you're dealing with at work. We get really bogged down in businesses and our personal life with processes and facts and just moving forward, that sometimes we forget about the people and the behaviors and who we are and how we think, and really kind of pay attention to those aspects, and so that you're getting to know your environment, and then you can make the next best decision. It really, there's no measurement for it except your own comfort level of how you're going to deal with the next messy situation you're in.
Get connected, connect to your environment, connect to your people, get connected. And you know, it all comes back. We're talking about human-centered leadership. And so how are you thinking? Are you focused on people? Are you focused on those processes and the systems we're a part of before you get down to that level of the tasks and the things that you're kind of immediately hitting your windshield? That's not easy to do, but the more that you do it, the more you'll be the leader you'd want your boss to be. Dr. Debbie Sutherland, thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
All right. Until next time.
The UPS store is making packing and shipping Easter gifts quicker than ever this year with UPS Air. How quick? Quicker than a walk around the park. Quicker than eating all the Easter candies. Quicker than finding a golden egg that you know is stuffed with cash. When you ship UPS Air at the UPS store, your items arrive on time or your money back. Guaranteed at no extra cost. Exclusively at the UPS store U.S. retail locations. Send Easter joy on time at the UPS store. Visit theupsstore.com/airguarantee for full details. Terms and conditions apply.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.